So, anyway, we are, as you know, continuing our studies of the ancient civilization of Assyria. And we have now had, two sessions, which have brought us up to the moment where we now are at the very cusp, at the very beginning of what is sometimes called the Assyrian Empire, or sometimes called the Neo-Assyrian Empire. And that really is the high point. This is the culminating moment of Assyrian history. And oddly enough, this period of Assyrian dominance, the Assyrian Empire, only lasts for about 130 years. And then Assyria just vanishes. I mean, it vanishes in the sands of the Middle East, so much so that for many, many years, people even doubted that there ever was actually an Assyria. And that is astonishing, really, because that is in perfect fulfillment of what the Hebrew prophets had said would happen. And it'd be almost unthinkable. It'd be sort of like us sitting here musing that in just a few years in the future, someplace like New York City would just be lost to history. The greatest, most dominant, most powerful, most threatening, impressive empire in the world just sinks into the horizon, not to be heard from again for another 1,000 years or so, you know, or 2,000 years in some ways. So anyway, it's quite a story. But we are coming right to that moment now where we see the greatness of Assyria, and in the middle of this, we'll get to it next week, is that one of the most wonderful Bible stories, I think, that we can ever come across, and it's when the great Assyrian king Sennacherib attacks and lays siege to Jerusalem. And you recall the story of Hezekiah, who seems to be in a completely despairing situation. He turns his trust to God. It's a wonderful image. He lays out the arrogant demands of the Assyrian commander in front of God, lays that letter before him. And of course, we have that story of the death angel coming and wiping out 180,000 of the Assyrian soldiers. Did that happen? Come next week and we'll talk about just what happened in the year 701 when Hezekiah somehow or other escaped the trap. Cannot hear it. I hear me fine. Really? Yeah, it really, you need more volume because it seems really loud up here. All right, friends. How's that? Is that any better? That's better? All right. I'll try not to create feedback as I run back over. So anyway, that's what we'll be looking at next week. And this week we want to look at the first three, basically, of these kings of the Assyrian Empire. And that'll bring us next week then to Sennacherib, who will occupy the bulk of our time. And then after that, we're going to be finishing out Assyria and really doing a segue into Babylon. Assyria was defeated by a coalition of the Babylonians and the Medians. And we'll be looking at the Medians a little later, but we'll be moving to focus on the Babylonians, and especially at that point, Nebuchadnezzar, another well-known, very prominent character in the Bible and also in ancient history otherwise. So that's what's coming to a future near you. This morning I want to look at Isaiah. This will more or less set the context for our conversation. There's three different texts that I want to refer you to, and all of them are against the backdrop now of this rising Assyrian threat. The first of them is familiar. It's one that we often hear during the Christmas season. It contains within it the reference to a young woman, a virgin, will give birth. His name will be Emmanuel, and so on. It has that text in it. It's Isaiah chapter 7. But this morning, we want to focus on it more in connection with the immediate significance of what was happening with Ahaz, the king of Judah, and the reason that this message was being given to him at that time. So this is Isaiah chapter 7. And if you'd like to follow along, we'll read about the first half of this chapter, and then a couple of other short sections from Isaiah as well to get us going. So Isaiah chapter 7, beginning at verse 1, the Word of God. In the days of Ahaz, son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram, and King Pekah, son of Remaliah of Israel, went up to attack Jerusalem, but could not mount an attack against it. When the house of David heard that Aram had allied itself with Ephraim, the heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, "Go out to meet Ahaz, you and your son Shear-Jashub, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, 'Take heed, be quiet, do not fear, do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of a firebrand, because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah, because Aram with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has plotted evil against you, saying, "Let's go up against Judah and cut off Jerusalem and conquer it for ourselves and make the son of Tabeel king over it." Therefore, thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand. It shall not come to pass. For the head of Aram is Damascus. The head of Damascus is Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim shall be shattered, no longer a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria. The head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you do not stand firm in faith, you shall not stand at all. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign of the Lord your God. Let it be as deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. But Ahaz said, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. Then Isaiah said, hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary mortals that you weary my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Look, the young woman is with child and shall bear a son and shall name him Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey by the time he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land before whose two kings you are in dread will be deserted. The Lord will bring on you and on your people and on your ancestral house such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, the king of Assyria." So there's our first text. Now, briefly, if you just jump over to Isaiah chapter 18, just the first couple of verses here. Isaiah 18, beginning at verse 1, Isaiah writes, "Ah, the land of whirring wings beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, sending ambassadors by the Nile and vessels of papyrus on the waters. Go, you swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth, to a people feared near and far, a nation mighty and conquering, whose land the waters divide." And then drop right down to the end of that chapter, verse 7. "At that time, gifts will be brought to the Lord of hosts from a people tall and smooth, from a people feared near and far, a nation mighty and conquering, whose land the rivers divide, to Mount Zion, the place of the name of the Lord of hosts." One more. Sorry, but we just have to do this, you know. This is Isaiah chapter 20. This is one of my favorite chapters in all the Bible. Verse 1 of chapter 20. "In the year that the commander-in-chief who was sent by King Sargon of Assyria came to Ashdod and fought against it and took it, at that time the Lord had spoken to Isaiah, son of Amoz, saying, 'Go and loose the sackcloth from your loins and take your sandals off your feet.' And he had done so, walking naked and barefoot. Then the Lord said, 'Just as my servant Isaiah has walked naked and barefoot for 3 years as a sign and a portent against Egypt and Ethiopia, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians as captives and the Ethiopians as exiles, both the young and the old, naked and barefoot, with buttocks uncovered, to the shame of Egypt.'" Makes you wonder why it's my favorite chapter, doesn't it? I mean, really, you have to think, whoa. But we'll just not go there. That's exactly right. And verse 5, and they shall be dismayed and confounded because of Ethiopia, their hope, and of Egypt, their boast. In that day, the inhabitants of this coastland will say, see, this is what has happened to those in whom we hoped and to whom we fled for help and deliverance from the king of Assyria. And we, how shall we escape? Aren't those great texts? Those are fun texts. So anyway, let's see if we can figure out what's going on there right after we have a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we are grateful to you for your many manifold mercies to us, rich and new each day. We thank you for this Lord's Day. We thank you for the privilege it is for us to gather freely in this place to converse about matters that lie at the very heart of all that is most important in life and in eternity. And we pray that as we take a look at these texts and of the setting of them in history, that you would give clarity to our conversation, that all of it would be to the honor of Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen. All right, well, as I say, we are dealing with Assyria, the Assyrian Empire. As we've been in the class now for the last few weeks, you know that Assyria has various eras, and Assyriologists have essentially divided this up into kind of chapters. So we've looked at Proto-Assyria, early Assyria, the period of decline, which really corresponds to the Golden Age in Israel, and then the last period before the present one would be Assyrian recovery. And we see a time in which Assyria begins to be gaining once again momentum and seems to be on a trajectory to dominate and rule the ancient Near East with their bloody, violent sort of methods. And all of a sudden, they just kind of go dark for about a generation. And last week, we were proposing that the time that they go dark coincides almost precisely to the time that Jonah would have gone and preached in Nineveh. There's no other evidence, there's no certainly external evidence from Assyrian annals as to anything that might have happened. It's just one of those interesting coincidences that does in fact seem to coincide rather neatly with about the year 780. That's when Jonah, beginning of the reign of Jeroboam II, would have gone to Nineveh, and it's at that point, for whatever reasons, Assyria just disappears. We don't have any annals, we don't have any records of their campaigns, we don't have any records of activity of any kind until we get to about the year 745. And it's at that point, roughly 40 years later, that Assyria comes back with a vengeance. And so this is the time we're looking at. And this Assyrian Empire, sometimes called the Neo-Assyrian Empire, lasts for only about 130 years, which is plenty of time. I mean, I'm not minimizing that, but this great dominant power that has been more or less rumbling around for some time now finally has its day in the sun for about this period. And we want to look at each of the kings because every one of them is mentioned in the Old Testament, some more prominently than others, but all of them do at least get a cameo appearance in the Old Testament record. The first of them is Tiglath-Pileser III, another characteristically good-looking guy. This is a stele from the walls of his palace at the British Museum. He left quite a few little sketches of himself that look something like this. And as I've mentioned before, you've seen one of these guys, you've seen them all. So I don't know what else to say about it. But anyway, he is considered the founder of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. It's called Neo-Assyrian because there was an earlier era where you almost had an imperial kind of presence of Assyria. Doesn't quite become as dominant as this one does, but some will call it the Neo-Assyrian Empire, and we'll at least use that term occasionally. He reversed the peaceful recent history of Assyria, what I call the Jonah effect. This is one generation in which Assyria had been quiet, and now with this guy, it all changes, and he comes back with a vengeance to reassert Assyrian presence and Assyrian dominance in the world at that point. He has, as is often the case, the need to put down revolts. It was typical in the ancient world when there was a regime change and a new king came to the throne that you would find that all of those who were out there resenting being under the thumb of this central authority would revolt. They would seize the opportunity of the kind of instability associated with regime change to revolt. And this guy was no exception. And of course, nobody knew at the time that he was going to turn out to be one of those powerful kings in the history of the ancient Near East. So anyway, they all sort of grab the opportunity, and he's dealing with revolts both in the West and in the East. In the East, the bulk of the revolutionary activity is in Media and in Babylon. And so those are the eastern regions that he has to deal with. He doesn't have much problem with them. Interestingly, just a little note to self here, it is Media and Babylon that will, in another 100 years or so, come back and actually bury Assyria. So right now, he wins the chess game, but it won't be that much longer before it will be a coalition of those two that will, in fact, put an end to Assyrian history as far as we can tell. So that's what he does in the East. Then he turns his attention to the West, which brings him to the vicinity of the people of God living there in Israel and the surrounding region. That would be the west of the Euphrates. And this is called the First Syrian Campaign. It takes place in 743. It's well documented. It's mentioned in the Old Testament. It's mentioned heavily in Assyrian annals. So we have a lot of confidence that this took place 743, within the second year or so of the reign of Tiglath-Pileser III. So he shows up. The ruling powers at that point are a guy named Rezin II, who is ruling in Syria, which is that little country north of Israel, and then a guy named Menahem, who is ruling in Israel. So Tiglath-Pileser shows up, he puts the squeeze on these two, and they immediately cave in. They know they are no match for the powers of the Assyrian army that are out there kind of posturing for a fight, and so they immediately submit, and what that means is they give him tokens of their submission and a promise to pay fairly substantial annual tribute from that point on. And that's all he cares about. He just wants revenue, and so if they'll submit, if they'll take an oath of no revolution and pay the tribute, then Tiglath-Pileser's happy. And so that's all they had to do. It is interesting that he did not continue further south. The next country he would have encountered would have been Judah, which was under the rule of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. But he doesn't do that. So basically, Jotham and Judah remain unmolested at this point. He gets these first two. Then he basically heads north and launches a campaign into the Hittite region, or the what was the remains of the Hittite region, because he's interested in the copper mines that are there. There was a very rich kind of treasure trove of copper mines in that region that was still an important element, and so that's what he's after. So he leaves basically the region of Canaan alone at that point, finishes that first Syrian campaign then in Anatolia. Then he goes back, he's involved in some other things, but our next real interest in him comes a few years later in connection with his dealings with the king of Judah at that point, whose name is Ahaz. So I'd like to just kind of map for you briefly what's going on back at the ranch before we have Tiglath-Pileser showing up once again about 10 years later. In Judah, we have Jotham. Jotham is the son of the good king Uzziah. Now you may know that Uzziah was really remembered as a very good king. He came to the throne fairly early, and he served well. But at a certain point later in his reign, at a moment probably when he was getting a little bit full of himself and a little puffed up with his own successes, crossed a line. And the line he crossed was trying to do what was common in the ancient Near East, namely unite the role of the king with the role of the priest, to unite religious and political authority. That was forbidden in Israel. The other ancient civilizations would do it commonly. The pharaoh was both a political and religious authority. The Assyrian kings had the same kind of qualifications, and others commonly would take that because it was viewed as a way to have absolute power. If I combine religious authority and political authority, no one can argue with me. In Israel, it was forbidden. If you were the king, you could not be the priest. If you were a priest, you could not be the king. We would call that the forerunner of our principle of a separation of church and state. It was a working idea in Israel, but the one exception was that someday one would come who would legitimately unite both authorities. And the office that would legitimately unite both religious and political authority was called the office of Messiah. So Psalm 110 celebrates the fact that the Messiah would bring together those two offices. Psalm 110 is quoted more frequently in the New Testament than any other psalm because it's celebrating this point, namely, first of all, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. That's kingly language. Later in the same psalm, the Lord has sworn and will not repent. You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. Priestly authority combined together in one person in Christ. And so, until Christ, no one could do that. But Uzziah tried, you know. And so he goes sallying forth into the temple, wanting to offer incense. The priests rise up in a holy objection. No, Uzziah, don't do this, you know. But no, he's not going to be stopped. And as he's actually apparently approaching the incense altar, God strikes him with leprosy. At which time, I think one of the funniest verses in the Bible, it's sad but funny, at which time the priests hurried him out, and indeed Uzziah hurried to get out of the temple, you see. So the point was made. But from that point on, for the last 10 years, Uzziah was a leper. He was king, but he was a king in title only. He had to be kept in isolation under Jewish law, and his son Jotham rules in his stead. And so from 750 to 735, Jotham is ruling in Judah. In 740, Uzziah the king died, leaving his son Jotham to rule for another 5 years. In the year that King Uzziah died, Isaiah tells us, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up. The train of his robe filled the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. You remember that text, Isaiah chapter 6? This is the commissioning of Isaiah. So the beginning of the career of Isaiah the prophet, it starts the year that King Uzziah died. And then he has a dominant role, of course, over the next many years in Judah especially, but also to some degree in Israel. So that takes place in 740. The successor to Jotham was his son Ahaz. Ahaz rules for 20 years. He's a wicked king. There are several descriptions of him in the Old Testament text. He engaged in blasphemous, idolatrous practices. He offered his own sons as burnt offerings and other ghastly things that leave him a reputation that is one of the worst in Israel's history. But he happens to be the king that succeeds after the death of his father Jotham. So that's what's happening in Judah. Meantime, in Israel, we have Menahem. Menahem is mentioned in the Old Testament, a king of Israel, but also in that account in the book of 2 Kings, you'll hear that in the days of Menahem, the Assyrian king Pul, P-U-L, invaded. P-U-L, Pul, that's Tiglath-Pileser. I don't know if it was like a nickname or what, but anyway, it's another name that's used for him. And that's referring to the 743 first Syrian campaign, at which time Menahem willingly submitted and began paying tribute. He dies the next year. He's helped along the way by his good friend and successor Pekahiah, who assassinated him. And I've always wondered about the name Pekahiah. It sounds like a version of hide and seek or something. I don't know, but anyway, Pekahiah. He only reigns for 2 years, at which time he's assassinated by his successor, whose name is Pekah. And he's, of course, mentioned in the text that we just read. What happens? In 735, so remember the first Syrian campaign is 743, so about 8 years later, the king of Egypt is trying to inspire, to orchestrate a revolt of the entire region. Egypt was the most free from Assyrian dominance. But nevertheless, the Assyrian presence in that region had really cut off their economic advantages. And so the Egyptians were always interested in running the Assyrians off, but they couldn't do it on their own. And so the king of Egypt is trying to get others in the region to sign off on a joint agreement to rebel as one united front against the Assyrians, believing that if they all did it together, the Assyrians couldn't take them all, you know. And so that was what the Egyptian king was trying to do. And that's happening about 735. Well, it just so happens that 735 is the first year of the reign of King Ahaz, young, inexperienced. And everybody thought he'd be a pushover, apparently. But he stands his ground. He says, nope, I am not going to participate in this rebellion, you see. Now, on the face of it, we might think, well, that's good, because these Jewish kings shouldn't be forming alliances with their pagan neighbors. They should be trusting God. So at least initially, we think, well, this could go either way, you know. But as we look beneath the scene, we realize that, you know, what's happening with Ahaz is not as honorable as we might have hoped. So anyway, what happens is when Ahaz declines to participate in this united revolt, then the two kings north of him, Pekah of Israel and Rezin of Syria, attack him. And it's a devastating attack. It's recorded both in 2 Kings 16, 2 Chronicles 28. And it does send a shockwave through Judah, reported by Isaiah as they were trembling like leaves in a tree blowing in the wind. You recall that in Isaiah chapter 7. So everybody's upset. Ahaz is kind of caught in the middle. What am I going to do? He's being attacked by his northern neighbors. He doesn't want to join in this revolt, and he's stuck in this situation. And as it turns out, Isaiah comes to him at that very moment. The text in Isaiah mentions specifically that he's out there checking out the aqueduct, and the reference is, it's clearly connected to the water supply for Jerusalem that Ahaz is concerned about in the event that he's put under siege. He wants to know that he'll still have, you know, working water supply, because that's the fastest way to starve out a population, is cut off their water. It's while he's out there surveying the situation of Jerusalem vis-a-vis this attacking force that Isaiah, who's a young man at this point, he's only been a prophet for 5 years, confronts Ahaz and says to him, Ahaz, thus saith the Lord, don't sweat it. Thou shalt not sweat it. It's right there in the text. It's in the Hebrew. You have to look closely. But anyway, Ahaz is not so sure about this. I mean, for one thing, Isaiah is just a young prophet, and who knows whether he's really speaking for the Lord or not. So we can understand that Ahaz might have a little bit of reticence before just naively, gullibly, you know, trusting this guy that comes along, purporting to speak for the Lord. But Ahaz seems at least to be somewhat less than enthusiastic about joining Isaiah in his message. And so Isaiah keeps pressing the point and keeps saying that these two that are attacking you are just smoking firebrands. They're going to be off the map soon enough. You don't need to worry about it. And when Ahaz continues to be reluctant, Isaiah says, okay, I'll tell you what. Ask me for a sign. What do you want to see? This will prove that God is going to protect you, because I'll give you any sign you want. Isn't that great? Wouldn't you like to be in that position? What do you think? World peace. I mean, what are you going to ask for at that point? You know, what sign? Fire from heaven, an earthquake, pizza for everybody in Jerusalem. I don't know. Ask for a sign. Some sign that will prove the competence of the God of Israel against these pagan gods that are now threatening. And of course, Ahaz gives this classic, oh, far be it from me to tempt the Lord, you know. And of course, it's dripping with hypocrisy, because at the very moment that he says that, he is already in a conversation with none other than Tiglath-Pileser, wanting Tiglath-Pileser, the Assyrian, to come and support Ahaz against these local threats represented by Pekah and Rezin, you see. So Ahaz is doing, this is the first time now that the king in Jerusalem is actually prepared to sell his soul to a foreign power and put himself in a position of being a tribute payer to some foreign monarch. And that's a critical thing that Ahaz is contemplating doing, and that's why he declines the proposal that's been given to him here by Isaiah. Well, Isaiah isn't so happy about that, and basically the thrust of what happens in Isaiah 7 is this. Okay, Ahaz, if you won't ask for a sign, God's going to shove one down your throat. Here's the sign. This woman with child. And it almost appears that Isaiah is pointing at someone. He uses a word in Hebrew which can mean either a virgin or a young maiden. I think you're probably aware of that. The New Testament picks this up and makes it a virgin. Parthenon is the Greek word, and it means a virgin. But at this point, the Hebrew word can be construed either way. It seems that Isaiah is pointing at someone, probably his own wife, who was, in fact, with child at that moment, and said that before that child is old enough to discern the good from the bad, those two that you fear are going to be gone. You see, that's the time frame. But unfortunately, in the last line of that chapter 7 includes, and you will not stand either, you see, because you, Ahaz, have refused to trust God in the face of his evident promise to watch over you and care for you. You yourself are going to be put in this horrific position, really, of having to pay incredible tribute payments to Tiglath-Pileser. There's more to be said about chapter 7, but that's kind of the basic sense. Of course, the New Testament picks that up, as it often does, and makes a secondary application of it to Christ, but in terms of the immediate setting, that seems to be what's going on. All right, well, Tiglath-Pileser, and this is, by the way, is recorded in Assyrian annals once again, does come on the second Syrian campaign, agreeing to defend Ahaz, and he does battle against Rezin and against Pekah, and they are both killed. And so within the time frame that Isaiah himself had pronounced, both of those nations are taken over by the Assyrians and cease to be a problem. But now Ahaz has just strapped himself to huge tribute payments that he will continue to make until some 30 years later his son Hezekiah revolts against the Assyrians, provoking the attack by Sennacherib. So there's a connection between Ahaz here and his son Hezekiah that we're going to look at next week. So, by the way, in connection with this, you may recall the story of Ahaz visiting his now ally, Tiglath-Pileser, in Damascus. On this second Syrian campaign, that's where Tiglath-Pileser set up his headquarters. Ahaz sees there a wonderful, beautiful altar to the Assyrian god Asher, and thinks, that's what a high-tech altar looks like. I need one of those in Jerusalem. He sends a blueprint back to the high priest in Jerusalem with orders to build such an altar and put it there in front of the temple, getting rid of that old worn-out altar that Moses had provided. And so this is just one of many points where Ahaz himself is departing, of course, from his responsibilities. All right, so that's Tiglath-Pileser. He dies a few years later, and the main involvement he has with the people of God is what we've just talked about there. The successor to Tiglath-Pileser is Shalmaneser V. Short reign, only rules for 5 years, didn't leave many records. The most significant record he does leave concerns events in the region of Judah, Israel, and Syria. Of course, during these years, Ahaz is simply continuing to pay tribute, so that's all there is to say there. In Israel, Pekah was killed, as we just said, in the attack by Tiglath-Pileser, 733. He's followed by the last king of Israel, Hoshea, and he rules from 733 to 722. Hoshea rebelled, for reasons that are not very clear, in about the year 724, and Shalmaneser engaged in about the only military campaign we're aware of in connection with Shalmaneser from Assyrian records, and that is an attack on Israel. He puts Hoshea under siege in Samaria for about 2 years, and in 722, Israel falls to the Assyrians. Now, there's certain dates in Old Testament history that should be on your short list of important benchmark dates, you know. In round numbers, the year 2000, Abraham is born. In round numbers, the year 1500, roughly the Exodus. In round numbers, the year 1000, David and Solomon and the building of the temple. The next date that should be a benchmark date is 722, because that's the date that Israel, the 10 northern tribes, are defeated and deported by the Assyrians. And the Assyrian king that was responsible for launching that attack was Shalmaneser V. But interestingly, he died during the siege. And we're not quite sure who it was who put him to death, but whoever it was, by birth, the guy took the name Sargon. And so this is now known as Sargon II. Because if you've been in the class, you know there was a Sargon I. Remember that? That goes way back. Right? Way back to Mesopotamia, one of the first couple of lectures we did. We had Sumer, and then Akkad. And the founder of the Akkadian dynasty was named Sargon. And Sargon built the first great empire, really, in history. And he was remembered as a great military genius. And so this guy, whose name was probably Hank or something, I don't know, but he took the name Sargon. And he wanted to take the namesake, of course, Sargon the Great, and have it applied to him. And he did turn out to be a quite powerful and competent ruler. And so we want to have a little bit of a discussion about him. Another very distinctive shot of him. This is in the Louvre. Looks a little squatty to me there. I don't know, but anyway. He was a usurper. He took that name, Sargon the Great. He is the one that actually oversaw the deportation and repopulation of the people that were living in the region of Samaria. This is where the idea of the 10 lost tribes came from, you know, because they were deported at that point. And the Assyrians then repopulated the region with people who came from elsewhere. This was part of their strategy to keep people more or less off balance. When you're yanked out of your homeland and put in a foreign place where you become the minority, where you're not familiar with the customs, the language, and so on, it makes it very difficult to organize much of a revolt, and the Assyrians knew that. And so they kept shuffling the deck and moving populations back and forth. And so from this point on, Samaria comes to be associated with a mixed population, racially mixed, but more importantly, religiously mixed. We're sometimes a little hard on ancient Jewish people because they have a reputation of being very racist. It wasn't really a racial bigotry that was driving them, but there was a strong anti-religious kind of attitude toward any that were not worshiping the true God. And that did become the reputation of the Samaritans. And so even up to the New Testament, we hear of the Samaritans in rather disparaging terms. This is where that all began, when the Assyrians brought in this foreign population from other parts of the world, and they kept a vestige of Jewish religion but mixed it with paganism, and that produced the hybrid type of religion that we commonly associate in the New Testament with the Samaritans. Well, Sargon had troubles both in the east and in the west. Again, with the regime change, there were revolts here and there. In the east, I'm going to take the time to mention to you this guy because he'll come up again next week, so make a note to yourself here. In the east, the main problem Sargon had was connected with a guy named Merodach Baladan. Merodach Baladan, we actually have images of him as well. It's a shot of him. He is a native Chaldean, meaning he has roots going clear back to ancient Sumer. He is supported by the Elamites. Elam has its capital at Susa, mentioned in the Old Testament, and Elam wants to try to join in a revolt against Assyrian dominance, and so they sponsor Merodach Baladan to go and take control in Babylon. And so he seizes Babylon at the regime change in 722, and people rally to support him. So Merodach Baladan actually shows up at this point in Babylon and asserts independence. And interestingly, for about 10 years, he's able to rule independently of Assyrian control. Now, the reason we're interested in him is because if you read Isaiah chapter 39, you'll see a reference to Merodach Baladan, king of Babylon, sending an emissary to Hezekiah. And that very short vignette picture of Merodach Baladan is going to show up in our conversation next week. So this is the guy we're talking about. He's been an independent ruler in Babylon now for 10 years. However, in 708, Sargon comes and drives him out. He goes into hiding in the kind of swamps of southern Mesopotamia and Elam. So it's later that he sends this message to Hezekiah, but anyway, just make a little mental note of him. All right, so then we have problems with Sargon in the west, and that interests us a little more at this point. It starts with Hezekiah, who is the king in 715. His father Ahaz died in 715. Hezekiah is a good king, and the first thing he tries to do is to restore the proper worship of God. And so you know Hezekiah has a great reputation, great PR in the Old Testament. He gets rid of that Assyrian altar. He gets rid of the trappings of paganism that had creeped into the temple worship area. He gets rid of all of that. He sponsors a great Passover celebration and tries his best to get the people to turn their hearts back to the Lord, which they do to some degree. It's not heartfelt as much as we might hope, but nevertheless, it's a start in the right direction. In 714, 1 year into his reign, the king of Egypt, whose name is Shabaka, sounds like Star Wars to me, you know. Guy named Shabaka, who is an Ethiopian, but is also the ruler of all of Egypt, sends an emissary to Hezekiah, requesting that Hezekiah participate once again in a revolt. You see, that's what the Egyptians are always up to. They're always trying to orchestrate revolutions. So this messenger comes, and these people are Ethiopian. They're tall, they're warlike, they are smooth-skinned, they don't have hairy skin, you know. They're described by Isaiah in chapter 18. They were considered some of the most ferocious, scary warriors of the ancient world, these Ethiopians. And the Ethiopian king Shabaka says to Hezekiah, "Hey man, if you will rebel, we'll be there for you. You rebel against those Assyrians, and if they attack you, you've got us. These powerful, scary Ethiopian warriors will be there to fight them off. So how about it?" Now, the Egyptians are trying to protect their trade interests, but nevertheless, they make that proposal. Hezekiah wisely consults with Isaiah. Isaiah says, chapter 18 of Isaiah, "Go, you swift messengers, to a land of awesome warriors, smooth of skin, and so on." And the crux of the whole thing is to say, go home. No deal, no dice, not making an arrangement with you, and send them on their way. So that's kind of the text that becomes the counsel of Isaiah to Hezekiah in the context of this overture that was received from Shabaka. As it turns out, others did agree, and that drew the Assyrians into the region. And so Isaiah chapter 20 says, "In the year that Ashdod fell to the Assyrians." We know from other sources that that would be the year 713, because now the Assyrians come back, Sargon in particular, and attacks Ashdod, which you can see right at the bottom of the map there, is kind of the city that was the buffer between attacks from the north and Egypt. And if it fell, it put the Egyptians in a difficult position. Ashdod fell in the year 713. Again, there was some temptation, some inducement by the Egyptians for Hezekiah to jump in and help. Help defend Ashdod. Help defend Egypt. Join us even now. And of course, the whole thrust of Isaiah 20, that very strange chapter, is this. Isaiah is told to strip, not to the buff. I know that's what it looks like. Really strip to his tunic. Still not very dignified, but he wasn't just, Anyway, he's prophesying now using a great object lesson, saying, just as I am here, in a sense denuded before you, so those powerful warriors of the Ethiopians are going to be denuded and led away, paying their tributes to the God of Israel as they're hauled off by the Assyrians into captivity. So that's really what's happening. And for 3 years, that was the promise that Isaiah was giving. And as it turns out, in the year 710, Egypt did fall. And so the Assyrians were able to break through the defenses, and Egypt, in fact, conquered by the Assyrians and became an Assyrian possession for a period of time. Hezekiah avoided all of that because he continued to pay the tribute that his father Ahaz had promised to pay many years earlier. So Hezekiah keeps playing that role. But it was also at this time that Hezekiah built his famous tunnel. So in the year 710, he built this tunnel. I don't know who that young man is modeling for us, but that is Hezekiah's tunnel. It was built in 710. The reason Hezekiah built it was in anticipation of his own revolution against the Assyrians, which he was already planning, but he wasn't going to do it in reliance on anybody else. He was going to do it in reliance on the God of Israel, but at the same time, he's not above building a tunnel to make sure they have a water supply. Has anyone ever visited Hezekiah's tunnel in Jerusalem? It's a kind of a tourist destination. Nobody? Have you really? Yeah. So it's does it look like that? Is that pretty fair? Yeah, there you are. Kind of a long tunnel. And that's how the water supply would come in. This takes place in 710. Of course, Hezekiah's revolt will be about 705. Hezekiah wasn't prepared at this point to rebel, but he's preparing the means of his survival on the occasion that he would. And he seems to be encouraged in that direction by Isaiah himself. In 705, Sargon dies in a fairly minor skirmish elsewhere, and that brings once again a regime change. And that's the moment that Hezekiah chooses to rebel. And the Old Testament tells us Hezekiah rebelled against the king of Assyria. That took place in 705 with the regime change from Sargon II to Sennacherib. And the greatest single confrontation between the Assyrians on the one hand and the Jewish people on the other took place in 701 as a direct result of that rebellion when Sennacherib came. He's the son of Sargon, and he is most famous for that conflict. So I obviously don't have time to go into that. That's our story next week. It's one of my favorite stories, and it is the story of the wiping out by the death angel of 180,000 of Sennacherib's forces. So we want to find out if there's any historical support for that. Did that actually apparently happen? Are there any other records that would suggest that it did? My Sunday school lesson for you this week is Hezekiah. He's the right balance. We always think about the question, what does it look like to actually trust God? We know we're supposed to trust God. We know that some people like Ahaz just refuse to trust him. Or in a kind of pretentious hypocrisy say, oh, I would never test the Lord, you see, while all the time building bridges with unreliable, unsupportable props of this world and not at all giving their devotion and allegiance to the God of heaven and earth. So Ahaz is one bad example. He's sort of the religious hypocrite who talks good talk, but when you get down to the bottom line, all of his money is invested in human stock markets, you know, and that's it. Now, on the other side, you've got those who trust the Lord to a degree that, at least if you don't mind me being, you know, giving my personal opinion here, is a little bit absurd and indeed insane. I've met people, and I hope none of you are in the room, not knowingly at least, but I'll go ahead and say it. I've met people who've said, I do not buy insurance. I trust the Lord. You ever met someone like that? Yeah. I believe buying insurance is a lack of faith. I think if I get sick, I think if some bad thing happens to me, God will provide. You know. Well, you got to appreciate the heart. But I'm not sure that really is what trusting the Lord actually looks like in the life of a sane Christian, you know. That there is such a thing as trusting the Lord and yet using what is commonly called means. Hezekiah trusted the Lord, but he built a tunnel. Now, he wasn't saying to himself, I'm going to trust the Lord, and if we need a tunnel, God will put it there for us. He didn't do that. He built a tunnel. That took some work. That was quite an engineering feat. Does that mean that Hezekiah didn't trust God? No, it means he trusted him so much that he believed those means might be used by God to bring about a deliverance that ultimately would be to the glory of God alone. But his trust in God didn't prevent him from doing sober, sane things that we should all be doing in connection with, you know, getting along in life in a way that makes some kind of sense. It's possible to trust God and yet at the same time to buy insurance. I don't know if in this room we have dissenting opinions on that, and if so, that's wonderful. God bless you. But, you know, at least that's what I think. And I bet most of you have insurance. And I bet most of you trust the Lord. And the reason that we do that is because we believe that while God works through normal human channels most of the time. And so what we want to do is place our faith confidently, consistently, on a daily basis, utterly, in God and His goodness, and yet at the same time live lives of responsible conduct in the circumstances of life. And I think Hezekiah is a great example.